In the lab at Unit HQ, a fine argument was in the works. Brigadier, I told you this morning I am a scientist, not a detective. Joe, the frequency generator on this thing is not working properly. Call down to... The Brigadier, not in the least put off by the doctor's dismissive attitude, interrupted him.
Now, listen here, Doctor. I've got Scotland Yard banging on the door with this. We're supposed to liaison with local authorities as they need us.
Well, do what you like. He leaned closer to the flickering screen of the oscilloscope on the workbench and squinted at it. Joe, get on that call with supply, will you? We can't move forward without a reliable frequency generator. She nodded and shot a look at the fuming and impatient Brigadier. He saw the glance and let her know with a single look that he was depending on her. Used to soothing the doctor and making peace when she could, Joe immediately went to the telephone and called down to the supply clerk. After a moment, when the Brigadier rocked back and forth on his heels and the doctor completely ignored him, she replaced the receiver. No frequency generators in stock, I'm afraid. We should see one Monday at the earliest.
Blast this infernal bureaucracy of bits and pieces. Look, Doctor, I really need you to spare some time to this case. I cannot do this without you. A young woman has been killed, and the circumstances are dubious, really extraordinary. We may be dealing with a Jack the Ripper here.
Brigadier, that is the lookout of Scotland Yard and the police force. As I said, I am not a detective. He was interrupted as Joe stepped closer to look at the O-scope. The Brigadier paused. Joe knew how to handle the doctor when he became stubborn. How do you know it's the frequency generator, Doctor? Maybe we could jury-rig something if it's just a short circuit.
I'm not a repairman, Joe.
But his voice was quieter. Ever since his young assistant had stepped in the way of an energy bolt meant for him and saved his life, the doctor had become downright docile with her. There were times when she was the only person at unit who could handle him. I thought it might be interesting. You could show me how they work. You're just dying to give me another lesson in electronics, aren't you? He smiled back at her. The Brigadier refrained from snorting. Unit's scientific advisor was impervious to all stratagems except flattery. Now that he valued Joe Grant so highly, he shamelessly enjoyed her admiration for him.
Well, we'll see.
With the crisis at Devil's End concluded, the doctor felt more at home. The adventure had been just odd enough, just dangerous enough, to satisfy some of his pent-up energies. And Joe's willingness to sacrifice herself for him seemed to have restored some of the happiness he had felt with his previous companions. He had a new confidence and trust in her. She glanced at the Brigadier as though suddenly aware that he was still there. Who did you say was killed, Brigadier?
A poor young woman from Northern Ireland, Miss Grant. Here in London, just a week after being married.
Oh, poor girl.
A very young thing, 21 or thereabouts, I believe. Ruthlessly murdered, and she's not the first.
And her husband?
Pegged as a culprit. That's the unusual thing.
Married men murdering their wives is as old as marriage itself, Brigadier.
They were very much in love by all accounts, Doctor, and he was a divinity student. They were on their way back from a midweek prayer service when it happened.
Does he admit to it?
Yes.
Well, I don't see where the mystery is.
Five murders. Five murders like this in the past month. Devoted husbands, lovers, boyfriends, ruthlessly murdering the women that they love. Completely unaccountable. And more women will die unless we can determine what's motivating these fellows.
The doctor hesitated. There were things he wanted to do at the lab, new ideas for building a dematerialization circuit that could bypass the interlock set in the TARDIS by the High Council of the Time Lords. And the doctor often had little patience with the infrastructures of highly organized groups like Scotland Yard. He actually did better with impromptu groups of people who would easily follow his charismatic leadership. Joe waited just long enough for him to consider, and then she rested a hand on his sleeve. Doctor, could you just go see the poor man that did this to his wife, just to see if you think there's something behind it that Unit should look into? She looked up at him appealingly. In spite of himself, the Brigadier marveled at her. Certainly, with her big dark eyes and earnest face, Joe Grant was hard to resist. The amazing thing was that she knew it so well and could work with complete confidence, persuading the doctor and convincing him that investigating this mystery was entirely his idea.
Well, if it matters to you, Joe, I could take a look into it.
He suddenly smiled and chucked her under the chin.
Or do you just want to play detective for a while?
I think I would feel better knowing why these women are being killed, if it's not just all a horrible coincidence. A look of concern passed quickly across his face, and he watched her as she went to get his cape for him.
You'll stay by me, then. Of course she will. Miss Grant, you ought to stay with the doctor. Understood?
She came back with the cape and her own jacket.
Of course, Brigadier. Not many places to run off to in a lockup.
It was hard to be afraid of Ronald McClellan. Joe had been prepared for a larger, tougher sort of man, perhaps one who would cringe and fawn on the doctor and try for sympathy. What they found when they were ushered into the cell by a stony-faced policeman was a young, very fresh-faced man who stood immediately at their entrance but kept his eyes downcast.
How do you do? I'm the doctor, and this is my assistant, Miss Grant. We'd like to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind.
You may ask your questions, sir.
He pointed to a single chair in the cell. Joe took it. He and the doctor sat on the small cot.
You know I killed my wife. I did it, sir. I don't know why, but I killed Mary.
McClellan's heavy Ulster accent somehow made him seem more pitiful.
Do you remember anything about it?
Oh, aye. We were at the service, little congregation that meets just a few blocks from this lockup. Everything was all right. I had to say a few words about the sister church back at home. I'm Northern Irish. And then we wanted to get away. People were eager to talk to us, though. Mary was that patient and congenial. A good minister's wife.
Were you annoyed with her?
Oh, no, sir. Impatient to leave, mind you, but I had to admire her. Her duty was to be kind and hospitable to folks, and she was doing her duty. Even on her honeymoon, I knew she wanted to get away with me. She didn't deserve what I did to her, sir.
What happened?
We got away at last. We walked back to the rooms we'd borrowed.
Borrowed?
Friends we knew through the church. They lent us their place while we were in London. The police have been over and over it, but I don't think there's anything there to explain it. It happened outside before we went in.
The report said you strangled her.
I did. And I remember it, too. I remember doing it. I know I did it. Mary, my poor wife.
But why?
What were you thinking when you did it?
It doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense what I was thinking.
Tell me anyway.
She had to hold still. I had to make her be still. She had to hold still beneath me, lower than me. I forced her down to her knees. I still see your eyes. What's happened to me? Mary, why did I do this to you?
We'll look into this. You may have been under some influence. We'll question the others.
You should have seen her on our first day. So surprised and pleased by everything. I had flowers waiting for her and a new dress she'd seen back home and couldn't afford. I got it for her and mailed it down before the wedding, so that it'd be all laid out when we came in. I'd never told her how beautiful she was until we were married. I picked her up and brought her through the door, and I forgot to put her down, you know. I just stood there, in that front room, telling her how beautiful and good she was. I always knew I was a sinner. But what strange darkness comes out of a man and kills the person he loves best and is most grateful to? What's inside of me to do that? Even a selfish and criminal man spares the thing that does him good and makes him happy.
Stan Bilkins was a few years older than Ronald McClellan and slightly more composed. He had been sitting in lockup for 2 weeks, but he was used to it. He accepted a cigarette from the doctor and gestured for his two visitors to sit down. He sat back on his cot with his legs stretched out, his back against the wall, the picture of a man accustomed to waiting for arraignment.
My generous of you, Gov. They won't let me have no smokes alone. Afraid I'll burn myself or something.
Why is that?
I was that suicidal when I first come in.
They got me on tranquilizers even now, but it ain't as bad as it was. Not since I met that minister fellow.
He jerked his head in the general direction of McClellan's cell.
What does he have to do with it? Come on, Gov. You think a bloke like that could find a stomach to kill his wife? I could have believed it of myself. I'd never hit Joan, never so much as spoke cross with her, not even that time she left the brake off a car and it rolled through the front of the flat. She was a good woman, was my Joan, but I was a bad lot and I knew it. So when it happened, they told me I snapped and done her in and I believed them. But now I don't know.
Why do you call yourself a bad lot?
Why, miss, I got a history as long as your arm. Nothing violent, just theft. A crate here and there from the back of shops. Nothing anybody would much miss. Got really drunk once and took off all me clothes for a dip in the Thames. The local constable patrol was not amused, but I never hurt nobody before. Never threatened nobody, never so much as laid a finger on nobody. Till I killed my Joan. I denied all the petty stuff, which I had a right will to do, and I enjoyed it. But killing her, there was no denying that, and I don't know why ever I'd done it.
He let his head rest back against the wall, and Joe realized that he was moderately tranquilized even then.
Can you tell us what happened? I just picked her up from the doctor's. She was pregnant. We just found out, just then, down at the Women's Health Center.
And you were not married.
Oh, don't be stupid. We were that happy. I said we should get married right away, but Joan said it was too funny to be wearing a wedding dress and looking like that. She wanted to wait till after the baby came and have a fancy wedding.
He drew his knees up and rested his elbows on them. He paused for a moment, and now it was obvious that he was trying to be coherent and clear. He looked at the doctor.
I was that impatient to know. They put me off by myself in a little waiting room, and I thought that must mean it was bad news. Like maybe something we thought was her being pregnant was something else. I was standing there in his closed-off little room, convincing myself Joan had cancer, promising God I'd reform and be a better man if he'd just let her recover. Finally, the doctor of the place come in, all smiles, tells me to come out to the front desk. And there's Joan, looking like the sunshine.
He stubbed out the cigarette on the metal frame of the bed and accepted another one from the doctor, but he forgot to light it.
I wanted to get her home. She was so happy. She told me right off we'd have to name the baby Sparky. She had that odd sense of humor. Could you imagine, she asked me, how people would look when they asked us what we would name the baby and we'd tell them we'll name him Sparky. She was laughing and laughing over that, had her one hand on me shoulder and neck, and the other hand on my knee as I drove, talking at me and laughing. I used to call her my bluebird. Nobody could be happy like Joan could be happy.
When did it happen?
Just after I parked car. I started to get hot. Hot beyond my ears. And mad. She kept moving, walking in front of me, moving. We went inside and she was going up the steps ahead of me. I bet she was still talking, but I couldn't hear her. Just the moving. So I leap up and grab her. She must have started screaming, but I didn't hear it. She kept moving, and it made me wild. I knew I could make her stop, and I did. She was finally still, because I killed her. Tell them I need a pill. I'll dream about her if they don't give me a pill. I've killed me woman and child.
The doctor was silent on the short drive back to Unit HQ. Joe did not think to ask him if he would take on the investigation. Her mind was back in the cells of the jail. It was not until they had returned to the lab and she was going through the automatic routine to make tea that he spoke of it. I'll need transcripts of the police interviews with all five suspects, Joe. She was startled out of her grim reverie.
All right. I'll see to it right away, doctor.
She plugged in the electric tea kettle and would have gone to rinse out the cups, but he stopped her with a hand on her shoulder.
You all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
She offered a faint smile and made to get the cups. He stopped her with just the slightest pressure on her shoulder and looked into her eyes. Does it frighten you, Joe?
It frightens me for them. Those men aren't murderers.
No, I don't think so either.
His eyes were quiet, gentle.
You don't have to.
This is my job, Doctor. I want to help you with this investigation. I can do it.
He stepped aside to let her get to the sink. I know you can.
Lethbridge Stewart entered the lab 3 hours later to find that it had been converted to a sort of police inquiry room. Transcripts lay scattered across the workbench, and requisitions for autopsy information were neatly stacked in an outbasket awaiting delivery. Joe had strung a clothesline across one wall and had hung up enormous sheets of white paper from it, each one annotating details from the transcripts and reports. She was still at work writing things up in two different color pens. The doctor was reading through one of the thick transcripts.
So I gather you found the case relevant to your work, Doctor.
Are there any more obvious statements you'd like to make before you pitch in and help?
Have you found any similarities?
Joe stepped back from the sheets. She glanced at the doctor and shook her head. He looked grim. Aside from the gender of the attackers and the gender of the victims, no.
They weren't all married and they weren't all in love. 4 out of 5 were between lovers or spouses. But there's one that was a nurse, recently divorced, killed by a postman at the clinic where she worked. They were strangers to each other.
Wasn't one of the other victims a nurse?
But at a different location, different job, killed by her husband of 27 years. She was the oldest victim. He was the oldest assailant, 52.
Time of day?
The oldest victim was killed at about 10 o'clock at night. The nurse killed by the postman was murdered at about noon. Mary McClellan at 9 o'clock at night. Joan Rourke at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The other woman at 9 o'clock in the morning.
I've got a call out for autopsy reports and biological samples, pending your approval. The brigadier fished a pen out of his shirt pocket.
Tell me where to sign.
Joe hand-delivered the recs for autopsy information and samples. And the next day she brought back a briefcase full of papers and a refrigerated case of samples. The doctor was eager to get started. She paced back and forth while he donned gloves and opened the case.
Look, why don't I go out and gather more information? We have 3 more men to question. They're all under guard. I'll be quite safe.
He was secretly relieved to hear her offer. As long as Joe was busy with tasks, things went smoothly in the lab. But once she got bored or curious, there were sure to be interruptions. Anything from endless questions to beakers and sensors being knocked over by accident. Early in her career, he had simply barred her from the lab whenever he was busy. But her loyalty and devotion to him now made that course impossible. It hurt her feelings to be pointedly sent away, and he found himself much more aware of her feelings these days. So he was quick to agree with her plan.
That's a splendid idea. Start asking those men for details of the day of each killing. What they did, where they went, what was said back and forth. We may unearth a link somewhere, even down to what they ate and drank.
Right, I'm on it.
Pleased at his confidence in her, she started for the door, but the brigadier popped his head inside, his eyes serious.
We've got another one, Doctor, but she's survived. She's down in hospital. I want you there.
The doctor pointed to Joe. Stick with your plan, Joe. I need those details. We'll come back and compare notes. She nodded. The 3 of them strode out together, intent on their tasks, but she left them to sign out a car, and the 2 men went outside to Bessie, the doctor's vintage roadster.
What do you make of it? If you uncover mere psychological aberrations, then we're off the case. It goes back to the sole jurisdiction of Scotland Yard.
In a single month. 5, well, now 6... Senseless attacks by men with no motive to kill, all within one city? 1 case would be highly suspect. Statistically speaking, it's impossible that each man was acting from a naturally occurring or non-induced psychological breakdown. They climbed into the car.
So you're saying...
Something made them do it. The doctor started the ignition and they rolled out.
The thing is, who's next to commit murder? I mean, it could be any of us. Any man, I mean. decent men like Captain Yates or Sergeant Benton.
Or you, Brigadier.
Or me, Doctor. How does a man fight an enemy he cannot perceive?
The five men were not all incarcerated in the same building. Jo wanted to go straight to the men she had not yet seen, but there had been something so pitiful in Ronald McClellan's grief that she detoured to pursue a second interrogation with him.
I was wondering if you could be a bit more specific about what you did that day, that last day with your wife.
He was now more composed than he had been the previous morning, and her return to his cell seemed to help him pull himself together. Apparently, a third party coming in to make some meaning out of events encouraged him.
Well, now.
He met her eye today, his own eyes still filled with sorrow and a humbleness of a man deeply ashamed. But he spoke clearly. She sat in the hard chair in the cell and pulled out her notebook.
Mary wasn't feeling well, and we had an appointment in the late morning to see a doctor.
She was that ill?
Oh, nothing serious, Miss Grant, but, this was the first time. I mean, the way the doctor explained it. Well, I'm a biological landscape, you see, and so was Mary, so when we, you know, had our first night together.
You mean she got an infection? This directness relieved him and embarrassed him at the same time.
Aye, miss, it hurt her to use the bathroom, but she knew all about it. She made an appointment with a woman's doctor, and we went down at 10. Mary said they might not even examine her, just give her an antibiotic to take. But no, they put me off in a little dark waiting room off the main one, and the doctor there examined her, but said it was just a minor bacterial infection. Mary got some pills to take and some waxy things.
You were put in a room off the waiting room?
I think when Mary first came in, she was that uncomfortable, you know, that maybe the doctor thought it was something more serious. The doctor said I might be better off in private and she would come get me.
Joe was writing at a furious pace.
But it wasn't serious. No, how could it be? Mary and I had never been with anyone but each other.
Who was the doctor you consulted?
Rosalind Mays, a lady doctor.
Joe shuffled through her many papers and notes.
At the Women's Health Center. Does that mean something to you?
I don't know. She slipped her notebook and papers back into the briefcase.
Another victim was at the Women's Health Center as well. I think that's all for now, Mr. McClellan. Please take heart. The fact is, there's a lot more to what happened than what we know. I did kill her, miss. Whatever we don't know, we do know that.
But we have yet to know why.
I don't believe you're a murderer, and I do believe you loved your wife very much.
After leaving him, she put in a call to the liaison at Scotland Yard. With their authority and reputation, they could get the records from the Women's Health Center more easily than she could. She had to drive through London to interview George Calley, the only one of the five men who had a history of violence.
That was years ago.
The constable led her down a short, dark hallway to the cells.
Told the wife to get out of his way when they were arguing. He said later he knew he was about to lose his temper with her and wanted to get away. She blocked his way and he hit her. It preys on him now, like he's being punished for it years after the fact. He's a bit dodgy from what he's done, miss. Not right anymore.
Unafraid of the prisoner, the officer swung the door open.
Callie, you took your medicine, eh?
The bare cell was so small that Jo felt a little claustrophobic as she realized she would have to go inside to get a decent interview. On the cot, which took up more than half the floor space, an unshaven man in his 40s sat and stared at the floor.
Go away. You can see him in one of the interview rooms, miss, or right here. I'm just outside the door.
She wanted the interview to be as informal as possible, so she smiled and nodded.
This will be fine.
She had not been afraid of either McClellan or Bilkins, but as soon as the door slammed behind her with its heavy iron sound, Callie looked up at her, his eyes alight with both malice and unhappiness.
Fine. Fine for some. Don't you know I'm a murderer? I killed my wife, and I'll kill you, miss.
She took the threat coolly.
Nonsense, Mr. Callie. I wanted to ask you some questions.
She set down the briefcase. He did not remove his gaze from her face, though her cool reply put him off his stride for a moment or two. It seemed incomprehensible to him that she should not fear him.
I said I'm a murderer.
And I would like to ask you some questions. He began to breathe more heavily, and Joe wondered if she should call out for the guard. But before she could do anything, Callie launched himself at her. In the confines of the narrow cell, there was nowhere to go to avoid his huge hands. He gripped her throat and kept his voice a harsh whisper as he bore down on her.
I killed her, and I'll kill you, because I'm a murderer, a no-account, an evil man.
He squeezed his hands into her throat, cutting off her air. She gripped her hands together and swung hard with her arms against his arms, loosening the grip just enough for her to draw one breath, but she could not break his hold. He pushed her into the wall and then began bearing down on her again, forcing her to the floor. Her vision went black.
I'm killing you like I killed her!
She could not call out, and her struggle to break free lost its strength. She felt the floor come up and hit her as her knees gave out, and still he was bearing down on her. His fingers rammed like steel rods into her throat.